Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome Shash Arial. He is the co-founder of Peak Vortex Capital and formerly investment banking at JP Morgan. Shash is here to give us a commercial real estate update. Shash, welcome to the show.
Nick, thanks for having me on.
Of course. So Shash has presented a great deck for us to go through some of the things he's watching in commercial real estate. So give us an overview first of a quick background, what you used to do at JP Morgan in the investment banking division, and what you do now with your profession.
Yeah, sure. So I started in the real estate investment banking group. We covered lodging clients, multifamily, big public REITs, private players, on the equity, debt, and M&A side. And then I worked at a institutional real estate private equity firm that had $30 billion in AUM called GI Partners, did data centers, life sciences. And now I started my own investment firm called Peak Vortex Capital about a year and a half ago. And we invest in hospitality assets, multifamily assets, and we could invest across a capital structure. So equity, debt, preferred equity, pretty opportunistic.
Excellent. And so I found Shash's work through his tweets about commercial real estate, specifically projects that are in distress. So he has a really good awareness of what's going on around the country from a distress side. So what type of hotels and office buildings are in foreclosure? What type of buildings are facing difficulty with their debt payments and maybe on the cusp of some sort of foreclosure or change of hands? So that's how we found his work. We're excited to get an update from across commercial real estate. So even though he has background in data centers and lodging and hotels, we're going to try to get an overview, including multifamily. Let's start here with this first slide, which is that even though we have stocks at all-time highs, REITs are about 20% off of their highs. So what are your thoughts here generally about REITs in relation to the stock market?
Yeah, so REITs, which is public real estate, is very correlated to interest rate hikes. And so although the stock market is at an all-time high, REITs are down around 20, the public side is down between 20 to 30%. And that's largely just driven by the rapid increase in rates.
Yeah, of course. And, we cover the correlation of stocks to movements in interest rates. And what we see that is that even though we experience times in which higher rates are affecting stocks in a very negative way, stocks are really showing that they have a life of their own and have experienced some of a decoupling, whereas REITs clearly have not and are really ticking more with real estate. REITs are ticking more with interest rates at the treasury side. Now, the next slide you have here, private market real estate, apartment values down 30% peak to trough. So we are aware of the oversupply of apartments that is either coming online or about to come online. So maybe you can explain this chart to us.
Yeah, so on the previous slide, public real estate down 20 to 30%. Private real estate, same story, down 20 to 30%. Office, let's go sector by sector. Office, everyone knows it's a bloodbath. Down has taken the largest hit. There is still office demand, and now it's largely an oversupply issue in the office space. Apartments, there's been a record amount of apartment deliveries over the last couple of years. They will slow down into 2026 and 2027. But as you alluded to, because of the oversupply, the increase in interest rates, apartments are also seeing a lot of distress today. But I'd say that's kind of the more distressed side of real estate's huge. And so in other asset classes like data centers, it's very, very green right now. There's an unprecedented amount of demand for these data centers driven by the AI boom. And that is the one bright spot in real estate today. I'd say everything else is either yellow or red.
And we're definitely watching residential real estate. It's going to be slower to react. And, we are seeing worrying signs of inventory spikes, price drops in residential real estate. But from a nationwide median price, it hasn't actually brought things down to a negative in terms of even the month over month or year over year numbers. We're waiting for that to happen, but it does appear that the main damage in real estate is being done in office and apartment. And of course, you talk about the data centers and the demand for it. Bitcoin mining, AI, compute, all of that is driving, it's driving real estate values in the data centers, but it's also driving the energy infrastructure debate. Where are we going to be building these data centers? Are they going to be close to renewable electricity plants? If they're not, how are we going to power the electricity transmission to these data centers? I know that that's not your area of expertise, Shash, but it's just for our audience, something that we are looking at and trying to make sure that we're factoring everything at once.
And I'd say further to that point, I mean, if you could get power, the hardest thing right now for data centers is power. Power is like the new gold. And so if you could get power to a site, I was talking to one of my old colleagues who's in the data, just raised a data center fund. They bought land for in a tertiary area of Ohio that's very data center friendly for $100 an acre. They did a power study, got the power there. They flipped it to one of the large data center, Meta, AWS, one of the large tech companies for 10x that, just the land, just entitling it. So it's amazing what's happening. If you could get power, they will build.
And that's really, I think, the value add there is them getting the lines to the property, and that's how they were able to 10x. It's not necessarily that the land suddenly became 10 times more valuable. So power is the new gold. Definitely, that definitely confirms some of the conversations that we're having and the way that we're thinking about energy infrastructure, especially from the Bitcoin mining side. Of course, Josh, you know that the companies that we're interviewing, they're looking for that cheap power. They're looking all around the world. I know you are a U.S. fund, but they're looking all around the world and to see what kind of agreements with governments that they can make to secure that cheap power, sometimes even power at a negative cost because of time of day dynamics and things of that nature. Your next slide here, more real estate assets are worth 20 to 30% less relative to 2021. So just a continuation of what you're talking about, this 20 to 30% drawdown in real estate.
Exactly. So I wanted to paint for the audience that we're essentially in a real estate recession today because of how correlated cap rates are to interest rates. And so on the leftmost column, we have an asset that we purchased in 2021. Imagine that it has $100 million of net operating income. At the time, we paid a 5% cap rate for that, which is $2 billion. Well, now on the bottom here, you'll see that the 10-year treasury at that time was 91 basis points. Today, it's around 4.3. So cap rates have also expanded. So if you have the same amount of income capped at a 7% cap rate, which is just the inverse of a multiple, your gross asset value decreases 29%. And a lot of times, most real estate transactions are financed with leverage. And so if we assume 70% loan to value, 1.4 billion of debt, you put 600 million of equity down in 2021. Well, today that's wiped out almost 95%. And so real estate is very correlated to interest rates. And because of the rapid spike in rates, most real estate asset values purchased in 2021 are down around 30%.
Yeah.
And that's evidence from the public and private markets that we saw in the earlier slides.
Absolutely. And this slide is so important for the audience. So I'm going to just walk through the numbers slowly for a second to explain what Shash is talking about. You have a $2 million property in 2021 at a 5% cap rate that becomes valued at $1.4 million a couple of years later just because cap rates went up by 2%. So it's a drawdown in 29% of the asset value just on interest rates alone. This has nothing to do with the economy, right? This has nothing to do with rates going up so the economy slows, so the property has less productive capacity or less capacity to generate cash flow. This is nothing to do with that. This is purely rates up, value down. This is the present value calculation we talk about when we talk about stocks. When rates go up and stocks go down, it's that the Excel value changed because the rate went up. This is an example of that. But when you overlay in the leverage that the investor spent $600,000 in cash in 2021, that is completely wiped out. And that's why it's a 95% drawdown of the equity, because you didn't spend $2 million. You only spent $600K. Now the $600K is completely gone due to just the change in cap rates. So bringing it back home to think about the Fed, you think about Jerome Powell, and people have accused him of gaslighting the public by, you know, saying that inflation is coming down and we're on the path to cuts because inflation is coming down. They look at inflation at 3% and they say, you're gaslighting us. It's really Powell knowing this math that is getting him to prepare the market for cuts. He can't unsee this math. And so real estate investors all around the country are telling him, you're way too restrictive. It's not that, hey, you know, you should be cutting rates soon. It's that you're actually a few percent too restrictive, and the whole thing can come crumbling down unless you relieve the pressure. So what are you hearing from your colleagues and thinking just about the Fed and the inevitability of cuts versus inflation being, you know, keeping cuts off the table?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I think if, like, let's just play it out. If rates go down 25, 50 basis points, the short end of the curve comes down. But then what happens if the yield curve gets uninverted and the 10-year stays flat? And it doesn't really help many real estate people. Most real estate transactions are priced off the 5 or the 10-year treasury. Short-term bridge debt is priced off the short end of the curve, so it would help bridge. But I would say, I think there's a, we'll get to this slide later, but I think a lot of there's an education problem in broader real estate, that thinking that if the short end of the curve goes down, then it's going to help everyone, every real estate player, which I don't think that's not necessarily the case. So it's going to be fascinating to see what happens.
Right. And so what Shash is talking about here is that, of course, and we can bring up this last slide. We can just go right to slide 9 here. When we think about the Fed cutting rates by 50 basis points, first of all, the 2-year yield is already 50 basis points underneath the Fed funds rate. So the 2-year yield already has 50 basis points of cuts priced in. So it's not like that would help necessarily bring rates down in the market. And it definitely wouldn't do anything explicitly to the 10-year part of the curve. It doesn't really bring it down. If the Fed cuts 3%, yeah, 10s might go down. But if the Fed cuts 50 basis points, it doesn't really bring the 10-year yield down, and that doesn't really help real estate developers get into more of a green area on their cap rate calculation. So excellent, excellent points there. Let's talk about supply growth. You mentioned apartment buildings coming online for the next couple years, and I see here that you have data from Green Street Advisors, which is also part of our data set. So talk to us about supply growth.
Yeah. So let's go asset class by asset class. Data center supply is booming. It's getting absorbed. It's healthy. Self-storage, ton of new supply during the ZIRP period. Occupancy rates are lower for the public REITs. It is an overbuilt asset class, I believe. Industrial, a ton of new supply. Vacancy is creeping up, but vacancy is generally in the 90s range, so, or in the 10% range. So it's healthy. The asset class is healthy. We're going through an onshoring phenomenon in the United States, so the demand for warehouses is there. Apartments are we've had a record amount of apartment deliveries over the last couple of years. And so there is oversupply in certain markets, including the Sun Belt. The Sun Belt markets are generally, you know, the South and the Southeast. Markets have boomed during COVID and boomed over the last few years. So think Texas, Georgia, Atlanta, those sorts of markets. They are overbuilt right now. Generally in those markets, they're red states. It's relatively easy to build. And so when money was cheap, a lot of new supply went up, and that is putting pressure on rent. So in the last slide, we had that net operating income line, which is basically the EBITDA for the real estate company, for the real estate asset. Unless there was a massive spike in EBITDA, then your real estate property is generally worth less compared to 2021. But what's happening in the apartment sector today, and we'll get to some, you know, actual foreclosures, is due to the increased amount of supply, a lot of folks, when they were underwriting these assets, they thought they would see 3%, 4%, 5% annual rent growth. Well, because of new supply, rents are actually going down in a lot of these Sunbelt markets. And so they overpaid for the assets because debt was pretty cheap. Now they have rents declining, and then they also have inflation in their OPEX. So insurance is going up, property taxes are increasing.
When we think about the economic data set that we get every week and every month, people are, they obsess over non-farm payrolls and they obsess over CPI. What we heard from Jerome Powell is that he is actually looking at spot rents. He's not looking at CPI necessarily to inform his decision. And so with Powell looking at spot rents, it means we need to be thinking about this. And that's, I'm talking to the audience here. That is why we're doing multiple real estate shows right now. We are thinking about spot rents coming down as the main driver for Jerome Powell's in a decision-making process. It's not just something that's on the fringe. Talk about these foreclosure assets.
Right. So this is a good segue into what's happening on the ground. So many assets, you know, we touched on it earlier, but 2021 assets are down 30%. On top of that, you have this oversupply in these markets like Texas. Texas, it's very easy to build. There's land for miles. Zoning is easy. So when money is easy and cheap, a lot of new apartments go up. And so there's been an excess amount of oversupply in those markets. And so rents are contracting. At the same time, you have insurance costs doubling and tripling in many cases, which is a large expense line item for the P&L of a multifamily building. And so what's happened in San Antonio, to give you guys an example, there is over 900 apartment units up for foreclosure in the month of July. And that's large. Most of these assets were purchased in 2021 with very cheap debt, very euphoric sort of pro forma assumptions. And so now we're just seeing the beginning of it. And I think, we will see more of these foreclosures in the multifamily industry over the next couple of years.
Is this a multifamily crisis, Shash, or is that too extreme of a word? I know that on, like you say, in broad commercial real estate, you have to talk about what sector it is. Can't just say that we're in a recession across the entire CRE. But real estate is in a recession, as you're describing. Is this a crisis developing in multifamily?
I think I wouldn't say crisis, but I would say it's a balance sheet issue. So the operating fundamentals, there are a record amount of deliveries going up. So it is overbuilt for the time being, but people still need a place to live. It's very expensive to buy a home today. So I think operating wise, it's still, you know, an attractive asset class. I just think for the next 2 years, with oversupply, with higher rates, there's going to be more distress in multifamily. But then again, new development starts because of interest rates going up have fallen off a cliff. And so in 2026, 2027, you'll probably see all this excess supply get absorbed and it'll get fixed. But I would classify it more as a balance sheet crisis rather than a broad operating fundamental crisis.
And so what do we know? The first order effect, what we definitely know is that there will be a lid on rents. Rents will face pressure. Rental, just prices across the country are going to be capped from an apartment perspective. Would you agree with that?
I would say it's market by market. So in the Sunbelt markets, I think rents will be flat or slightly decrease. I think in markets where it's been hard to build, so think about, you know, maybe New York, California, those markets, it's been pretty hard to build. Institutional capital isn't really flowing to those markets because it's not really landlord friendly. And so those markets, I think you'll still see solid rent growth. And then there are some Midwest markets that are just haven't been built in or touched for a while. So it's really market by market, but I think the Sun Belt is where you will see flat or negative rents for the next couple of years.
Got it. So we have close to $1 trillion in commercial real estate loans maturing in 2024. A big part of those, big portion of those is multifamily going forward. So give us your thoughts on the bank side of these CRE loans. Are there any pockets of these that you're worried about defaults in 2024, 2025 on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing it. Most of the paper here is held by the regional banks. They haven't started selling their paper yet, but we're starting to see debt funds we're bidding on a loan portfolio of land, multifamily, hotels. That guidance for the portfolio is 50% of par. So they're trading for 50 cents on the dollar. Not really good assets, but you're starting to slowly see paper trade. On the regional bank side, they're selling all the assets that aren't really not the paper for the good assets. So they're starting to sell the office paper. But I think you will see more paper start to trade, and we're at the beginning innings of it right now.
And Josh has a really great perspective, guys, because when he's talking about banks trading paper for 50% of par, what he's talking about is a bank that has issued a loan. The loan has become either non-performing or in some sort of default scenario. They have to get the loan. The bank has to get the loan off the balance sheet, but it's marked at 100 because it's still assuming for its shareholders that it's generating the income that it when it at the time it when it issued it, but that's not the case. And so when a bank sells that paper and moves it off the balance sheet, you have to price it at the market value, what the current value is, because there's a new investor, like perhaps Shasha's company, that's buying the paper away from the bank, and now they own it for their cost basis is 50% of what the bank's cost basis. And so in that way, assets get written down, and in that way, banks are at risk of taking just larger asset write-downs and eating into their equity. So this is something that we'll need to be watching at the regional bank level, which is, I know, not something that you cover. You're trying to get their distressed assets off of their balance sheets, but we'll definitely be watching that as well. Any thoughts here before we go to CLOs?
No, I think you hit it spot on.
Okay, so CLO distress rate, now 10%. These are collateralized loan obligations. So taking a bunch of loans, packaging them, and allowing them to trade as securities. We see Japan, a large buyer of US dollar CLOs, just historically. There are really entities, there's pockets of investors that understand the risk of CLOs, and it makes the segmentation on the demand side pretty distinct. But with that being said, talk to us about what you see in the CLO market.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at this chart, it's not the up and to the right that we want. This chart was put together by my friends at CreditIQ. But CLOs, the way we interact with them is they appoint a special servicer. And so if there's a loan in distress, you have to go through the special servicer who represents the bondholders. And so the special servicers are fee motivated. They get paid based on duration. So they haven't started to really engage yet on trading these assets or actually being strict with the borrowers. It's been more so extend and pretend. But I think with this delinquency rate going up, there will be more and more pressure on the special servicers to actually come to a solution and realize that, you know, the loans are completely, a lot of the delinquent loans may be underwater.
Yeah, I think that we need to be watching the CLO delinquency rate and really any of the internal metrics of defaults within the CLOs, because what CLOs give us the ability to do as market observers is get a sense of delinquencies when a lot of that paper doesn't trade. So go back to what we just talked about. The paper doesn't trade until it's bought by a distressed investor, whereas CLOs have more on the live side of things. We get metrics on what's underperforming within those metrics, because the servicers have to relay that information to whoever the bondholder is. Why didn't I get my full coupon? The servicer has to say, because some of the internals are defaulting or are delinquent. And so we're definitely going to keep our eye on CLOs. Shash Ariel, Peak Vortex Capital, thank you so much for your commercial real estate expertise today and giving us an update from around the multiple sectors, multifamily, data centers, office, and all the like. Please tell people where they can find you online.
Nick, thank you so much. You guys could find me on Twitter at ArryalReal1994 or at peakvortexcapital.com. That's PEAKVORTEX capital.com.
Great. Shash, Ariel, thanks again for joining us, and we'll catch you guys next time.
Thanks, Nick.